Greece is the word today, cultists, and it's time for a little summer loving. Yes, cult doesn't necessarily mean underappreciated. As we saw last season, even the big movies can have cult followings. And seeing as this is officially labeled a cult movie, well, it would be just wrong to ignore it. That's right. We're tuning up the hot rods, dressing up in poodle skirts, and getting ready for a sock hop. All the while attempting to stop Mike from doing his own personal hand jive. We are going to go back to the 70s for this one, or is that 50s, and head on over to Rydell High to take a look at one of the most iconic musicals to hit the big screen. It's another special episode we've got for you this month, based around a popular movie, so naturally quite a few people wanted to be in on this. Hopefully that bodes well for the next hour and change as we sit around, paint each other's nails, style each other's hair, spill the tea, and everything else you do at a sleepover. I'm DK, your regular host on these things. And joining me today, we have the pretty much ubiquitous host of Media Matters. Yes, he's everywhere. It's Mr. Mike Wilson. How are you doing today, fella?
I'm good, thanks.
Now, as soon as this one was dropped into the schedule, you leapt at it. I take it it's one that means a fair bit to you, yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, it means a lot more. I've kind of mentioned this to you off air. It means a lot more to other members of my family, but it's one that I kind of grew up with. So it's either some kind of Stockholm syndrome situation or it was just drummed into me so much that, you know, because it's one of my sister's kind of top three probably favorite movies of all time. And she's owned it on like video, DVD, everything, and watched it so many times. So whether I like it or not, I've seen this movie like, you know, dozens upon dozens of times because, well, you know, we grew up in an era where you only had one TV and one video recorder in the house. So if somebody was watching something, you had to watch it with them. This, Dirty Dancing and Ghost were, I think, the trio of films that I have seen a million times, whether I like it or not.
So to keep sweet with your sister, it'll be a five from Mike before we begin. So, yeah, next up, I think you last heard them on Cult Classics, where they, like Mike, lauded the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's Rune. Welcome back.
Oh, hi, thank you.
Now, you've had three appearances on Cult Classics so far. First for Little Shop of Horrors, second for the aforementioned Rocky Horror, and now this one. I'm noticing a pattern here. Like Mike, I think it's safe to say you're a bit of a fan of this genre, yeah?
Yeah, a little bit of a musical theater nerd.
Nice one. I'm expecting another high score there then.
Okay.
finally, you first heard her on last season's review of 1941, where she emerged remarkably unscathed. Here she is as part of her continuing appearances this year. It's Adrienne. How are you today?
Hello, everyone. I'm here from the land where they filmed this show. So,
now, you've been quite enthusiastic about jumping in on these episodes this year. So not only do I have to thank you for that, but it begs the question, are these films ones that you like or are you just here for the witty repartee? I'm hoping it's the former because otherwise...
Oh, whoa. Yeah. No, actually, I love being here. I love the repartee. But this is a great part of my childhood. I mean, I was one of the kids that ran out and bought the album. So that's how old I am. I played it in my room.
I'm just glad to have you here. All right. So, yeah, that's three guests wanting to discuss this one, but that's not quite all. We've got a special treat for you fans of this movie, as we'll be joined by a mystery guest later on in the show. Ooh. So, as I said, it is a special episode, so just stick around. Now, all three of our guests here have been on the show before, so the Desert Island Movie question's a bit of a moot point. But since we're talking about one of the most famous musicals out there, I'm going to ask them a different one. So, Mike, point blank, what's your favourite movie musical? No stage show performance, just your favourite Hollywood, in inverted commas, musical.
We were not warned about this. I was not prepared.
That's what I mean by putting you on the spot,
dude. Welcome to the world.
It's going to sound really dodgy because it's the most recent musical and the most recent I've seen, but I was just that impressed by it so much that I have to shout out Wicked. Wicked Part 1, so that's what I'll go with.
That is a good one. I wasn't expecting that answer, but yeah, that is a good one.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, Rune, how about you?
Also Wicked. It is just incredible. But if we're going to go with something not super new, I would have to say Little Shop of Horrors is probably my very favorite film adaptation.
Oh, nice one. I wasn't expecting that. I thought you were going to head for Rocky Horror.
Oh, there is that one too. Well, stop. Okay, well, let me tell you, like, Little Shop of Horrors has like sentimental value to my Michael and me. So I'm gonna let that one take its place.
Oh, cool. How about you, Adrienne?
Well, if there's a musical that I have to choose to be on all the time in my house and I can't escape it, it would be Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah,
my mom's favorite.
Yeah, absolutely. What?
I've still never seen that.
Oh no! Really? What do we have to do to this guy, Mike? We need to get like duct tape.
Don't ask Mike.
Oh. I know, it's just like Rocky Horror, and I sing all the songs all the time, and I know the exact order they go in, and I'll sing them alone in my car. That's the only place I'm ever alone.
Oh. Hang on, so that means the only real performance you've seen of T'Pol is Flash Gordon?
No, he's in For Your Eyes Only.
Oh my word, that's not better!
Okay, so we'll get on to today's, which is Grease, obviously. It's a 1978 musical romantic comedy directed by Randall Kleiser from a screenplay by Bronte Woodard and an adaptation by co-producer Alan Carr, based on the 1972 stage musical of the same name by Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey. It stars John Travolta, Olivia Newton-John, Stockard Channing and Jeff Conaway. The film depicts the lives of greaser Danny Zuko and Australian transfer student Sandy Olsen, who develop an attraction for each other during a summer romance and what follows. It was filmed in the greater LA area in 77, more specifically at Venice School, California. It was released in the US on June 16, 1978, becoming a success both critically and commercially. The soundtrack album ended 1978 as the second best-selling album of the year in the US, and the song Hopelessly Devoted to You was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song at the 51st Academy Awards. The film also received 5 nominations at the 36th Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, and 2 for Best Original Song for Grease and You're the One That I Want. And, raise your glasses, folks. It's that time again, because in 2020, Grease was selected for preservation in the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Yeah, Grease can be found on physical media and digital formats. And come on, if you can't find it, then honestly, dude, it's time to give up. So yeah, unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, because from that point, the only way is up, I saw Grease 2 years before I saw the original.
Wow.
Yeah. I had seen clips from the first one, obviously, but never the full thing. A friend was watching the sequel one afternoon and ended up having to sit through the Maxwell Caulfield, Michelle Pfeiffer, let's say, experience. After that, being the cool rider that I am, I thought better to steer clear of the franchise for a good while. It wasn't until years later I saw the first one. I had a day off from work. I was building a little model kit and the Beeb was showing it on TV that afternoon. So I put it on in the background and I was amazed how much I enjoyed it. It was just like nothing like the sequel. Yeah, went out and bought the copy on VHS just a couple of weeks later. And a few years later, I was weirdly enough cast as Kaneki in a local production. Weirdly enough, though, I'll always associate it with the building of that model kit. So it's weird how the memory works sometimes. So, yeah, how about you? Can you remember the first time you saw this one?
I have no idea when I saw this the first time. No recollection at all. Obviously, when I was a kid, at least, but none. I have no idea.
I saw this in the movie theater and I had been gifted the record to borrow from our neighbors. It wasn't until after the movie that I went and bought the record for myself. And I'm pretty sure I still have it. One of my boxes in the garage.
I'm pretty much the opposite of Rune in that I have nothing but kind of ubiquitous memories of Grease. But yeah, I mean, the very first time I watched it, as I said, would have been when I was really young. And it would have been when my sister was watching it on her video cassette copy. And it would have been just like, you know, in passing, she would probably had it on. And like I said, you kind of had to either sit and watch what everybody else was watching or go about your business. And I was either distracted and doing something else, but kind of half watching or decided to watch it. But for whatever reason, that would have been the first time. And then, like I said, it got drummed into me multiple times after that when she was watching it. And it just became kind of, it's kind of followed me in weird ways throughout my life. Because then obviously after she had the video, my sister got the soundtrack, which was huge. It was as big as the movie. I remember it being in like a green CD with the movie poster on it. And so she listened to that in like the car or whenever she could and everything. So I kind of had to, even when I wasn't seeing the movie, I had the songs drummed into me. And then just very randomly at like a school, I think it was a talent show or something, was asked to perform Summer Nights with somebody and was very acutely aware that I knew all the lyrics without realizing that I did. It was like, oh, okay. So I guess I'm doing that then.
Please tell me there's a recording of that somewhere.
God, no. Thankfully not. And yeah, just one of those things. Like I said, I remember being randomly in a bowling alley for the very first time with some friends when I was at university. The Grease soundtrack came on and they were all really freaked out because I was just mouthing along to the words and knew every word of every song. And I was like, it's followed me for years, guys. It's just one of those things. So yeah, it's always been a part of my life in a weird way.
Would you say, and this is to everybody, is it one that you rewatch with any regularity?
No, I wouldn't watch this anymore. But it was really rewarding to watch it, to refresh this, but I knew every word of it and every movement. So it's always in my brain.
I mean, not now, but I had no choice, like I said, for years. So it isn't something I would necessarily go to, but it's one of those that if you see it on TV or whatever, you know, and it's, even if it's 5 minutes in, half an hour in or whatever, there's many a time I'll be like, oh, there's nothing else on. Let's finish watching Grease. We know it well enough, you know. So,
yeah, we'll get straight into it. And we'll start with the writing. And Kleiser apparently took numerous liberties with the original source material, most notably moving the setting from an urban Chicago setting, as the original musical had been, to a more suburban locale. As well as that, there were quite a few song changes, but I'm just wondering what you guys thought to the writing. I'll come to you first with this one, Mike.
The writing in general, I think it's really good. It's obvious that it kind of plays with things like high school archetypes and stuff that it seems almost obvious to mention it, but I mean, it was the 70s, so it was before we really had, you know, this explosion of every other show being, you know, Dawson's Creek or Saved by the Bell or whatever. So I think high school archetypes weren't really what they were. And I also think it does a good job, as you kind of alluded to, of even though it's the 70s, it's pretending to be the 50s, and it kind of captures that moment in time, you know, when you had, you know, gang culture and greasers and rock and roll was hitting America or whatever. So, yeah. And I think it taps into that a little bit, the kind of 1950s youth in rebellion sort of phase as well. So it does a lot, and it seems almost relatable on some level because we've all been, you know, coming of age. And I think it's one of the earliest coming of age movies that I can remember watching or ever existing, really, and ever sort of, you know, relating to on that level.
Oh, I liked how it was only a glimpse of the high school kids. You know, you didn't see their parents or any jobs or anything that I can recall. But how the only adults were like the tropes of how a school principal would be or a producer of a show would be, you know. So I thought that they really covered all the bases of a coming of age story.
I struggled with watching it over the last couple of days, just because I found it so, like, it just doesn't hold up to what we have standards wise. Not the writing style, just like the content itself was.
I get into that later about like some of the creepy stuff.
It was it was really difficult for me to watch because of that. And I was like, this would need so many edits.
It would be a very short movie.
If I had daughters, I wouldn't, it wouldn't be something would watch with them. Yeah.
I read a review earlier while I was just flicking through Letterboxd, and one of the reviews just pretty much summed it up. It's systematic, high dramatic, problematic.
I love the songs and I know all the words. It doesn't translate well for today.
Yeah. No, the music's extraordinarily catchy and timeless, but the words are problematic.
Yeah.
You know, if people, especially kids, are watching this kind of thing and they pick up these kind of attitudes, it doesn't help matters socially.
It doesn't. And I think that the movie industry and any of those industries that have that kind of platform have the responsibility of making sure that they're putting out a particular kind of message.
Yeah.
From the very first time I saw it, I remember hating the ending.
Even though
it was one of those things that was kind of it was almost like a sexual awakening until I matured a little bit and was like, do you know what? I genuinely think I prefer Sandy before the whole makeover. Although, like I said, I don't think you're supposed to take a deeper meaning from every film, and I don't think the film is saying this. I think I've always been kind of uncomfortable with the idea that it's basically like, hey, girls, change, get a man.
Yeah. You know,
it's kind of, yeah. Oof. Although I will say I've always kind of liked that they do balance that out by showing throughout the film, and especially at the end, that Danny is willing to change for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they kind of did try to subvert it in Grease too, right? Because, you know, it's the dorky guy that turns out to be the, you know, cool motorbiking dude and whatever else. And, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer is the pink lady that's cool and popular. So they try to subvert it and it made a terrible movie, I guess. So yeah.
So, we'll get on to the direction. I mean, it was the highest grossing movie of 78 at the time of its release. The third highest grossing film worldwide after Star Wars and Jaws. It was so popular during release that some cinemas were playing the film literally back to back to meet demand. However, they couldn't turn over the audience quick enough. And by the time the last viewers to enter the screening took their seats, the movie had already started and was partway through, which increased demand for viewings even further as people had to attend the cinema several times just in order to try and catch the whole movie. After adjusting for inflation, apparently this is the highest grossing film to ever reach number one at the domestic US box office.
Wow. That's awesome. I love that.
Do you guys have any thoughts on the direction of this? Randall Kleiser, did he do a good job? Anything that stood out for you?
Well, I thought it was well paced. I mean, that's like editing, but I remember thinking it's just got the right timing for all the musical pieces. Nothing goes on too far. Nothing is overdone. You know, you have to have some sentimental pieces thrown in. And I thought that was well done.
Weirdly enough, I thought there were some slight issues with pacing this time around. Because I was watching it critically, I just kind of thought, for example, that whole scene where it's Danny like finding which sport to take and it's like a comedy montage. When I was watching that this time, I was like, this is the first thing I would cut because it just stops the film dead and goes on way too long. And it's the same joke like six times in a row. So
I didn't agree. I remember thinking it was dumb when I was a kid. And now I remember thinking this is awesome. He's doing all these funny things that should, because, you know, John Travolta was kind of a big thing at that time, you know? So he had to have his alone time where he could be funny and he could do all
this. It's an entire dance number to himself in the friggin' sock hop moment.
But that's what I'm saying. You know, I mean, you guys have seen Saturday Night Fever, right?
He was actually cast in this before he signed on to do Saturday Night Fever, and he started rehearsals just 4 days after completing filming for that movie.
Oh, wow.
Speaking of Saturday Night Fever, I had no idea until this time when I watched it on the Blu-ray that the opening song, Grease, was written by Barry Gibb.
No?
Nah, isn't that cool?
Grease is the word, yeah. Performed by Frankie Valli and written by Barry Gibb from the Beatles. Yeah.
Apparently, they did it because it very much linked Saturday Night Fever. Although, you know, obviously, it takes place in the 50s, making it even more anachronistic. But Kleiser, he hated that song. He felt the lyrics were too dark and cynical for the light, fun movie he was making.
Which song is that? Grease is the word.
Grease is the word, yeah. And it had nothing to do with the movie, but he put it in anyway after pressure from producers and the studio to have as many tie-ins to Saturday Night Fever as possible. It became a hit. Yeah, it wasn't featured in the original musical, and it's nothing to do pretty much with the movie at all.
The preferred version of the director is on the Blu-ray. They have a different song that they were going to use and that he said he would have preferred to use for the animated intro. And I've got to say, it's freaking terrible. So I disagree with the director because the original choice of song, it does not work. And it's a really bad song. It sounds almost like a pep rally sort of fight song. So instead of the cool, like Grease is the word 50s setup, it starts and it's like G-R-E-A-S-E.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, this is terrible. This would not have opened this film quite as well, you know.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention is the animation part at the beginning. That whole animated thing. I liked it. I don't remember it that much as a kid. But I liked it this time going, that is really stylistically cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like that it sets up the kind of tongue-in-cheek humor that the film has of not taking itself seriously.
Yeah,
I remember even not really understanding the nature of like setting up tone and stuff when I was younger, I remember finding it hilarious that it like shows you Sandy, you know, getting out of bed and she's like basically Snow White with all these woodland animals.
Yeah, that was so neat. It's like, they really wanted this movie to be a fairy tale set in the high school times with the Prince Charming and a princess and all these things. And
yeah,
I like that.
Whether it's the director or the writers or whatever, though, I will say there's a surprising amount of humor in here in the movie, and I think it all really works. I love the like the principal and her assistant, like the
comedy characters, and so many.
The you know the Naughty sleazy sleazy TV host so character, funny, and yeah. I
didn't like really him good. Though. That was so creepy.
I hate the
Vince Fontaine Marty thing. Like
very creepy.
I could be wrong, but I think I read somewhere that in the stage play or whatever, he's not supposed to be an adult. It's meant to be like he's a senior in high school. But it's just one of those weird things where they cast somebody and it feels like
Super creepy. He's like 40.
I mean, to be fair though, so is everybody else in the town.
Hey, Stalker Channing pulled it off, so there's that. I loved her in this film. She was great.
Stalker Channing and Dee Dee Korn, I think, are the two that steal the film, surprisingly, really good performances.
I do like some of the dialogue in this. Some of the dialogue, you know, there are some good lines in this. And she's, you know, do you think these glasses make me look intelligent? And she's like, no, I can still see your face.
Right.
And I like that.
I mean,
there are some serious.
I'm not very hungry. Just give me a double polar burger with everything and a cherry soda with chocolate ice cream.
Yeah.
I like how bitchy Rizzo is, because it's like, I remember hating the character, you know, until she warms up a little bit at the end, but also finding her really funny with her bitchiness. I can't remember any particular dialogue, but there's a few sort of moments of undercutting people. And the one thing I do remember is like during Summer Nights when they're all doing that kind of, you know, stereotypical musical performance, and she kind of just breaks the immersion by pushing them all over. onto the Dee Dee, pushing Frenchie into Sandy into the bin or whatever. And I'm just kind of like, that's brilliant.
I think it was well staged. I've got no complaints with regards to that. And you know that such musical numbers as Summer Lovin', where they're on the bleachers, I think it's done. Mm-hmm. It's set up really well, right through to the end with the singing at the carnival. The one thing that I always forget is in though is the Sandy song where he's singing at the drive-in.
Oh, I love that. I've always remembered that. I love that.
I don't know. I must be traumatized because I always blank it out.
That's so weird. I vividly remember that. I would shout out that I think that Randall Kleiser manages tone really well, especially when you think that he's switching a lot of the time between what are clearly like dream sequences and the real world. So, you know, the way that Grease Lightning or Beauty School Dropout, they're not reality. It switches to, like I said, a dream or a fantasy, or whatever you want to call it. And I think it does it really well. And it never feels jarring. And you don't question it. It's a trope of musicals and you kind of accept it nowadays. But I think, again, back in the 70s, it might have been jarring. And I don't think it is. I think you just kind of like you go with the flow with it and it works really well.
Speaking of the casting, Henry Winkler, who obviously became the sensation as Fonzie, was considered for the role of Danny. He turned it for fear of being typecast, besides which he's also confessed to being completely unable to sing. But weirdly enough, it was the success of Grease on Broadway that ignited ABC's interest in Happy Days. Yeah, Carrie Fisher, Marie Osmond, and Linda Ronstadt were considered for the role of Sandy. When Olivia Newton-John was cast, her character's background had to be changed. In the original Broadway musical, she's an all-American girl whose last name is Dombrowski. Obviously, she became then Australian. Jeff Conaway, he's 6'1½". He had to walk all the time slightly stooped, so John Travolta, who is just a little higher, would appear a lot taller.
So silly.
Lucy Arnaz was the first choice for the role of Rizzo. She was allegedly dropped from consideration for the role when her mother, Lucille Ball, called Paramount Pictures and said, "I used to own that studio. My daughter is not doing a screen test." Thanks, Mom.
She's entitled to do what she wants. She's responsible for us having Star Trek, so she can say what she wants.
She gets a pass.
Yeah. The original Broadway Rizzo was played by Adrienne Barbeau. At the time when this movie came out, Adrienne was appearing on Maud, the movie Maud. She was passed over to play Rizzo in favor of Stockard Channing, who is actually 1 year older than Babbo. Rizzo's hickeys were real. Stockard Channing said in an interview that Jeff Conaway insisted on applying them himself.
Oh, wow.
That would never happen these days.
No. No.
The intimacy coordinator would have a fit.
I was just going to say.
Oh, my gosh.
Eddie Deason also appeared in I Want to Hold Your Hand, the other big rock and roll period piece of 78, although obviously not as big as this one. He became popular playing stock nerd characters in movies. Laser Blast is known as Eddie Deason's first acting debut, and, you know, stick around Occult Classics, it'll come up. But,
yeah, but he was in 1941, remember?
Yeah, but this movie was filmed first. Writer and producer Alan Carr wanted Andy Warhol to play the art teacher.
Wow.
But one unnamed studio exec said he would not have that man in the movie, which Carr interpreted as the executive having a personal vendetta against the artist. So, as well as little known actor Lorenzo Lamas, it actually features Michael Biehn. Yeah, when Danny and Kaneki put the frog in Patty's bag, he's seen that scene. He can also be seen in the scene where Coach Calhoun's trying to show Danny how to play basketball.
That's cool.
Wow.
Love it.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, we ended up with the cast that we did. Any thoughts on the acting with regards to this one?
No, I love the acting. I think the cast, like, I can't even envision another cast.
I couldn't take my eyes off of Stockard Channing. And it's funny because she's such a scene stealer, right? When she was in West Wing, it's the same thing for me. Like, I just think she just captures the eye. She's so great.
I don't want to downplay how good Travolta and Olivia Newton-John are, and I think their solo performances kind of sell that to you. But I do think it's a really well-cast ensemble, because I don't think there's a weak link. And like I said, when you look at like what should be minor characters, like Dee Dee Korn as Frenchie or Stockard Channing as Rizzo, or, you know, even like Kaneki, or really small roles, like you said, like Eddie Deason as Eugene, he gets his moment to shine at the end with the kind of, you know, oh, I want you, kid, you're a great pitcher kind of moment like that. And like I said, the comedy kind of double act of the principal and the assistant or the coach, they're all kind of established actors that are coming in and doing a bloody good job. I don't think there's a weak link amongst any of these actors. There's not like a, you know, somebody lower down the call sheet that's turned up and they're just there for a paycheck, or they're just there to, like, the smallest of roles, like, you know, the Martys and the Patties or whatever of the film are all incredible. And I think it's very rare that you don't have anybody in it that you're like, ooh, they just, yeah, they probably should have recast that role or whatever, you know.
Weirdly enough, I'm going to go with Olivia Newton-John. She made an impression on me this time.
And
I'm,
definitely,
when she was playing Sandra, not the end version. I think she did really well, and every scene that she's in makes me kind of side with her. Maybe that's why I don't like the ending. I feel kind of a bit betrayed, as it were.
You truly believe Sandy's a good person.
Yeah.
But I still believe she's a good person. It's not like she hauled off and socked Rizzo in the face. She's still a loving, free. She's still free and happy, and she's just kind of taking more control of her life instead of like maybe how her parents wanted her to be. The cigarette scene is still an incredible scene, because she's still Sandy. She does not know how to put that cigarette out. She has to be shown.
Yeah, yeah.
I did find that kind of funny.
Yeah.
Speaking of and Sandy, what are your thoughts on this theory that the entire thing is her dying?
It's just such nonsense.
It's just all because of that car.
It's so stupid, because I've already mentioned it, like throughout the film, whenever they're, you know, doing a musical number, it switches to a fantasy sequence. It's not supposed to represent objective reality. And yet everybody has such a problem with this freaking flying car at the end. It's not supposed to be literal, you know. It's movie trope logic. I worked that out when I was six or something when I first watched this.
I could never buy into that. And I'm just thinking, have people this media literate that they think it's literally flying? So so my MVP in this one, it's Olivia Newton-John. So what about
I wanted to agree with you on that one, actually, and say that I think she's incredible. It's amazing. You see how talented she is, and I completely agree with the Oscar nomination for Hopelessly Devoted to You, because it's just a powerhouse, incredible performance. And I think the overall performance, I think, of Sandy is incredible, and it really is. You know, she has to hold up the movie, and she does, and you immediately fall in love with her, and she's got great chemistry with Travolta.
I do have to say that after buying this on VHS, after I was kind of blown away from it the first time, I watched it again on VHS and thought, this is brilliant. So immediately went out and bought Xanadu, which was one I'd seen when I was a kid, because I thought, this is brilliant. And then I watched it and I'm like, oh.
I'm with you. I did the same thing. Every time I see Olivia Newton-John, I'm like, she's so good. Let's immediately go and watch something else she's been in. And yeah, Xanadu is not really the best option, yeah. I think, in that one.
Yeah, I definitely give it to Olivia Newton-John. She really did well. I think she was shining. I can't imagine it being Marie Osmond, even though I love her too. Ooh. And she could have really knocked it out of the park. But I just think that Olivia Newton-John did it too, even though Stockard Channing is the scene stealer.
They're all so good. They really, truly are. I wouldn't recast anybody, but I'm going to give it to Didi Khan because Frenchie is just my favorite of everything. She's just so sweet. And I don't know. I feel like that character like helps balance out all of the yuck that you kind of get.
She does.
She's about the only saving grace in the sequel.
Truly.
She turned back up to do it.
Yeah. No, Eugene was in there too.
Oh, really?
True, yeah, true.
She's just so kind of life-affirming.
Yeah.
She's sweet, yeah. She's the sweetest and nicest and most accepting of the Pink Ladies, for sure.
The accepting, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll move on to the production design. And apparently the high school, it's right next to a pork plant. So everything smelled like bacon throughout the entire shoot.
Nice.
And, yeah, the cast chewed in total 100,000 pieces of bubblegum during the sheet, which averaged up to 5,000 pieces a day. I dread to think of the person having to scrape that pavement.
Who counted that?
So, yeah, there's not much in the way of special effects on this, you know, other than a flying car. But what do you guys think to the production design? I think they nailed the look very well. Yeah.
I think the production value was great. Like, it was simple. It wasn't overdone. You believe that you're in that era. I enjoyed it. So to shop, all the little places that they go, the drag rate, like great. Okay. I think you felt being there, and it was authentic feeling.
I agree with Rune. I think it was really well produced with all. I loved all the colors. I loved the costumes. I just thought the costumes were great. I loved how they had, especially like the dancers and stuff. I thought it was great.
I would just second exactly everything that the others said. I would say, yeah, great set design. The choreography is incredible. Cinematography, as I said, is great, bright, colourful, fun. And as Adrienne just said, the costumes are iconic. I mean, even the simplest of things, the 1950s outfits that they wear, the pink ladies and T-Birds jackets. And it's, you know, it seems authentic to the time.
Yeah, that movie brought back those satin jackets here in LA for a while. Like all the kids wanted them in school. I remember I got a satin jacket, but it was baby blue and it was just not the same. I still wore it, of course.
So we'll move on to the sound design. And apparently several musical numbers from the stage version, they weren't used in this movie, including Freddie My Love, Those Magic Changes, and It's Raining on Prom Night, though they do appear as jukebox tunes or band numbers at the high school dance.
Oh.
Yeah, Hopelessly Devoted to You was written and recorded after the movie had wrapped. Olivia Newton-John's contract for Grease stipulated that she should have a solo song. However, nobody got any ideas for a song for her character until Olivia's producer, John Farrar, came up with Hopelessly Devoted halfway through the shoot. Director Randall Kleiser wasn't convinced by the song. God, he's for a director of a musical. He should have better taste.
He really does not have a clue. Like this movie is really iconic and good despite him rather than because of him, isn't it?
Yeah. And so he had to come up with an entirely new scene to fit it in. It was eventually filmed and recorded after the movie had wrapped and earning the film's only Oscar nomination.
Wow.
Oh.
So, I mean, we've touched upon it, but every single song, I'll say, apart from Sandy for me, it's pretty iconic. But do you have a favorite?
Can you pick?
I think Grease Lightning is the one that made me happy as a little kid. I remember jumping around my bedroom and doing all the funny moves. Like, I think that's a cheerful, happy moment for everybody.
The one that I sing along to and know all the lyrics to is Summer Nights, and that's the one that sticks in my brain. But I think in terms of the best actual performance and song, it probably is Hopelessly Devoted to You, but they're all good.
Yeah,
they're all amazing. I think the one that stands out the most to me out of all of them, like most fun, it would be Grease Lightning, though. Yeah.
In terms of the songs, though, I really love, on a character level, Rizzo's performance, her solo of There Are Worse Things I Could Do.
Oh, yeah.
It's the moment that we finally see her kind of facade cracking and see the, you know, what she actually feels. And the other songs are all great, but they're just reinforcing stuff you know. And I think that's the big one that's like, wow, okay, we're actually seeing a little bit more about her character here.
Like if they, you know, like how Star Trek does books about characters and deep dives. If there was a deep dive on Rizzo and we found out about her upbringing, she might come from a family with some dysfunction, but she still pulls it out. You know, that's how I picture it. Like she had to be a little tougher, grow up a little faster, as it were.
Yeah. Side note, I had no idea until watching this time that her first name is Betty, even though she mentions it in the film.
Call me by my first name.
I would normally say Summer Lovin', but watching it this morning, the performance of Hopelessly Devoted to You, it just kind of blew me away on this one. So I think that's kind of slid into my number one spot.
Yeah, she pulls it out, but I just could never. I probably listened to it only once in my life. It was so sappy. I'm like, I'm not devoted to no guy. Let me dance around my. Let me do this other fun stuff. That's just sappy. But now I understand, you know, why they wanted to put that in there. You know, every musical needs something like that. And at least they had John Travolta attempt to sing to her as well, you know. So, I mean, I think it played off each other well there.
Yeah, although the sausage jumping in the hot dog bun behind him kind of ruined the moment for me.
Yeah, that was one of the things where I think I know it more from the soundtrack, and then when you watch it in the film, it's so friggin' distracting. Yeah. You're just watching this hot dog advert playing up behind you on the driver.
I think I like Hopelessly Devoted to You because it kind of captures that first love vibe to me.
It does.
Where you're so infatuated with someone and it's kind of the end of the world if things aren't going right. And I do like that.
I think it's of a particular lineage as well, because all musicals have that one sort of really heartfelt song, and it usually is the best. If it's not the most enjoyable necessarily, it's usually the best and most heartfelt. And I'm thinking of things like Suddenly Seymour from Little Shop, for example.
Yeah.
Is the kind of equivalent, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, to use my more modern example, The Wizard and I from Wicked.
So, yeah, after the success of this movie, which was, you know, obviously the top grossing musical in the US to date, it was supposed to have three sequels. However, after Grease 2 bombed at the box office.
James Cameron want to make these? What the fuck?
Yeah, they were cancelled. Now, in 2002, Didi Conn, Olivia Newton-John, and John Travolta were all pushing to have a Grease 3 produced, which would have focused on the original cast and characters many years later, like in the 70s or 90s, but it never got beyond the planning stages. According to Didi Conn, in an interview, there were plans for a sequel named Summer School, which was kind of sprung out of where the coach is in the pie stall at the end and says, I'll see you in summer school. But after Grease 2, Paramount Pictures nixed that one. And apparently, I didn't know this, there was a short-lived TV series, Grease, Rise of the Pink Ladies on Paramount Plus. Have any of you guys seen
it? Yeah, it was very recently, and it immediately got, like, shit-canned and removed.
Was it not very
good? One of the controversial... I have no idea, but it didn't look particularly good, and it was one of the ones where, you know, when they did all those removing stuff and pretending it never existed, and they got, like, rid of Willow on Disney Plus.
Like Willow, yeah.
It was one of the ones from there that people were just like... Yeah, it was immediately taken off the service and they pretended it didn't exist.
Fair enough. Wow. Now, in March 2019, it was announced that a prequel called Summer Lovin' was in development from Paramount. The project would have been a joint production collaboration with Temple Hill and Picture Start. John August signed on to serve as screenwriter, but as of August last year, there's been no further word on the project.
See, I don't think that would work, because the whole joke is that the start of the movie plays like an old kind of sweeping Rock Hudson type romance, and to do that for an entire movie would just be exhausting.
I think it's one of those things where, obviously, a movie studio, it's one in the money, but some films are just better off as a solo project.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask, what is it that does it for you as far as this movie goes? Is there a particular aspect stands out? It can be anything, writing, a certain performance, technical aspect. What makes you look forward to coming back to this one when you do have to come back to it?
When I saw that you were going to have it, I said, oh my gosh, am I really going to go back that far, you know, back to my childhood and something that was, I used to play records in my room of it. And when I really decided to do it was that there was just a little family get together and my cousin, she's like 28, she played a couple songs from it. And I was the one who knew like the moves and I like knew all the little steps and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, this is in my blood. I'm going to come on. And I had not watched it since I have had children. I mean, so I haven't watched it for almost 30 years. And wow. I watched it just a couple nights ago to get ready for this. And I remembered everything. Oh, our poor brains. I can't remember what I ate yesterday, but I know all the damn how to put out a cigarette if I need to.
The music is just absolutely iconic. I don't have the connection to it that y'all all have, but I can hear the music and be really excited about it just the same. It's just minus the lyrics. It's so phenomenal. It is something I would definitely listen to. I was, we've been doing a big house purge lately and I was going through all of our old vinyls and I do have Grease on vinyl. So
that's maybe cool.
I'll give it a spin.
Love it.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that's what our guests here think. But what about you? As usual, we put out requests for your thoughts on our socials. So, yeah, we'll head over to Vianne to hear what you had to say. So, Vianne, yeah, what do the audience think?
Hey, DK. So, as you said when you sent me this feedback, Grease is not something that's particularly near and dear to my heart. But I know it's a cult classic for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of people who really enjoy it, starting with Nick here. Nick says, Grease has a bit of a special place in my heart. It was one of the very first films I saw at the cinema. My brother took me to see it when I was around 8. It may have even been a birthday treat, and I fell asleep for part of it. Understandable. Which is more to do with my age than any critical response. I still love it now. Great songs, and just a damn good time. I can easily ignore its questionable message of having to completely change who you are to get with the one you like, and high school kids played by 20 and 30-somethings and just escape into it for a couple of hours. I'm glad you enjoy it, my friend. I know it's special to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons, and it sounds like you have some great memories tied to it, and I'm glad for that. This one is a little bit longer. It says, I first watched Grease at a concernedly young age. However, after my first watch, I was stuck to this movie like Olivia Newton-John's skin-tight leather pants. I recently found an old tweet from my mother that stresses the obsession I had with this film. Despite her love for Grease, I had somehow managed to make her grow sick of the film after forcing her to watch it 100 times a day. Sounds like me and my brother. He loved The Wizard of Oz. I couldn't stand it. I own the film and Grease 2 on DVD in a pink sleeve, which after years of consistent rewatches became so scratched it was no longer watchable, much like me and Madonna's I'm Breathless album. However, I can go a cappella, and I will. My favorite character will forever remain Rizzo. She isn't as one-dimensional as your typical strong female character who strives for independence yet still falls under the male gaze, lacking in personality or depth. Instead, she receives the greatest song in the entire musical detailing her struggles with relationships, self-identity, and emotional vulnerability. It is easy to argue that the premise of the musical is problematic, given the fact both main characters dedicate so much time to completely transforming themselves for the other. Whilst Danny picks up a new hobby and gives up his F-boy ways, Sandy takes up smoking and squeezes into skin-tight clothing that must be surgically removed. However, it did give us Danny's miserable man song, Sandy, and Sandy's hopelessly devoted to you, and the look at me, I'm Sandra D reprise. Or reprise, depending on who you ask. All songs being a dramatic moment for me during my one-woman drunk performances of the whole musical, so I suppose they get their points for that. Just so you know, that's me in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Overall, I give the movie a 4 for its nostalgia, the incredible songs, and Rizzo, but I'm deducting a point because women changing for men, bad. And that's Jess Great Rex. I hope I said your name right. So Jess looks like she got a lot out of this, and Derek Tate says, I first saw this musical at the cinema in October 1978. And I've loved it ever since. Fun stuff and excellent songs. Watching the oldest teenagers on film since 1958's The Blob does make me laugh, though. Great point, Derek. This one doesn't have a name, but it says, I love the film Grease, as I love the feel-good songs, and also how it shows the importance of friendship. The love story is corny, but you find yourself wanting Sandy and Danny to make it and drive off into the sunset together, as you can see he is just a guy with a big heart underneath all that macho front. I'd give this film a 5 out of 5, XX, kiss, kiss. Sandy says, I used to love listening to Grandpa's 8-track player, so I'd sit in front of it with that huge headphones on and listen to Devo and the Grease soundtrack over and over and over again. Seems like a lot of people have really fond memories from childhood. Janie Jane Marley says, my sister hates musicals. Grease is the only one she gives a pass to. Janie, you need to introduce her to Sweeney Todd and My Fair Lady. And then she puts in parentheses, until this December, when she watched Spirited and enjoyed it. Heather Kotso, loved it as a kid. Definitely one that doesn't hold up too well now. Not the songs of the movie, but the quote gist of it. Totally, Heather. Perry Brooker, never could stand Travolta, so I've never seen it. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting feedback on that. One thing I do like about this movie is the theory that as they drive off into the sky at the end of the film, that it's actually a metaphor for dying, and this whole thing was Sandy's fantasy as her brain lacked oxygen when she was drowning. And I'm always like those kind of meta discussions of things. So, not my jam, but I think it's great that so many people have such a big tie to this film and the musical, and that it has a big place in people's hearts, because too often movie musicals, especially these days, are shuffled aside and considered corny. So with that, back to you, DK.
Thank you as always, Vian. Much appreciated once again. Thank you to everyone who took the time to let us know what you think. And don't feel bad if you missed out. We're always listening. If you want to drop us a line regarding this movie or pretty much any other movie, on our socials, links in the description. Assuming all you listeners out there are still with us, we did promise you a special treat, a special mystery guest. We've got a special friend of Silver Screen Podcast. I managed to talk to him for a little while ago with regards to Grease and his time working on it. We're going to go over now, and we're going to talk to a Mr. Eddie Deason, who played Eugene in the movie.
Hi, this is Eddie Deason. I'm the guy in Grease. I'm the guy in the Polar Express and a lot of much worse movies, a lot of turkeys. I want to say hi. This is me being on my friend DK's show at the Cult Classics podcast.
Well, I'll get straight into it. What was the shoot like on Grease? And did that colour, because it was one of your first kind of roles, did that colour your expectations working on a movie set going forward?
Well, I was kind of spoiled because I started in, it was a big budget movie. It was Paramount, not necessarily big budget. It was $6 million, but it was a major film for my first film. You know, then I went after that is where it kind of went down. I went into a B film called Laser Blast, which was, you know, low budget, rock bottom. We filmed out in the desert, you know, trailers. So Grease kind of spoiled me. Grease was on Paramount set. We filmed on locations at 3 different high schools, you know, and it was first class. You know, we got good food, good costumes. You know, it was Paramount Studios, so it was major. Even though $6 million is kind of low budget, it was a major production. So it was a joy to film. You know, it was fun. It was. If you could say you got spoiled, it's kind of like your first girlfriend is like Marilyn Monroe. You know, you get spoiled, yeah. And then all the others are kind of down. But being in Grease for your first film, you got kind of like spoiled. You go, are all movies going to be like this? And in the following years, I did some major ones. I did 1941, and I want to hold your hand, War Games, and then of course Polar Express. But I did a lot of B's in there. You know, a lot of B movies where you know you basically your dressing room is your car. You know, you get scale. You know, although I did get paid scale for Grease because it was my first movie, but Grease was top notch all the way. You know, it was a first class production. Yeah. And it was fun. People always say, what was it like filming Grease? I always go, remember the greatest party of your life, the funnest party you ever had? I go, imagine going to that party every day for 2 months. That's what it was like with filming Grease. It was like going to a great party, seeing your best friends, you know, every day. And, you know, you dance and you have fun, you laugh. And it was a joy all the way through.
Oh, fantastic. Were there any, you know, on that vein, were there any cast members that you got on particularly well with?
Let's see. I loved, Eve Arden was a really good friend of mine. I loved Eve. We would talk all the time. She'd tell me about the Marx Brothers. You know, she did a film with the Marx Brothers, and she was a very special friend. Interestingly, she wasn't in the cast, but John Travolta's sister, Annie Travolta, was there, and she was a very good friend of mine. I would talk to Annie. She was there when we did the dance scene, you know, where they did the dance off. Yeah. And she was there all the time, and I talked to her. She was a very close friend. Let's see. I mean, everybody was nice, but they were really close. Who else was I close to? Dodie Goodman was a good friend. You know, Blanche. I was friends with some of the faculty, you know, as opposed to some of the greasers.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the dancers I was close to, a lot of the extras I was close to, but not necessarily the cast so much, because they would kind of, you know, the T-Birds would be together, the Pink Ladies would be together. I hardly ever saw Olivia. I would pass by John and say hi sometimes, you know, but it was mostly those kind of people, you know, different people like that.
What's your fondest memory from that production?
From Greece, oh my God, just so many. It was just such a joy, so much fun. Just, you know, because being in the movies was my life. It was my life goal. And to be in a beautiful movie like this was, you know, such a dream. I guess the kindness of John Travolta, John was exceptionally nice. He always called me buddy. You know, he never called me Eddie. He called me buddy. He'd always say hi to me. And my first scene, you know, I walked down the stairs, you know, and the T-Birds messed with me. And after every take, he would go, "You okay, buddy? Are you all right, buddy?" He'd make sure I was okay. He's like an older brother. You know, and I, you know, they'd go, "Take two." I'd come down, T-Birds would mess with me, and they go, "Cut." He goes, "Are you okay, buddy? Are you all right, buddy?" And he made sure I was okay. He watched over me. My best memory is kind of like getting Grease, getting the audition was kind of like, it's a religious story. You know, I don't know if you're religious, if you're a religious person, but I got cast in Grease. I went to the audition for Grease, and I got dressed up. I put grease in my hair because I figured it was called Grease, you know, so I put grease in my hair. Then at the audition, Alan Carr was there, the casting director. Joel Thurm, the casting director, was there. Alan Carr, the producer, was there. I'm sorry, Alan was a producer. And the director, Randall Plaiser, was there. So I went into Paramount. It was a big cattle call. All these guys were dressed like Fonzie, you know, in leather jackets, and all the girls had poodle skirts, you know, and saddle shoes. And I went in, and I was kind of different. I was in a little Pee Wee Herman suit, you know. So they called me in, and I read. And I noticed as I had like three or four lines all I had in the movie, you know. So I read my lines, and I noticed they were nudging each other. They nudged each other, and I thought that was good. It's a good sign. They're nudging each other. It shows they're interested. Then a couple days later, Paramount called me and said, "We want Eddie for Grease." So I called my parents. I called all my friends. I said, "I'm in this movie, Grease, you know, with John Travolta living in it." John was the biggest star in Hollywood, you know, so I was, yeah. I'm going through the roof. This is my first movie. So I told everybody. A couple days later, Paramount called my agent. They said, "Eugene is a small role in the film. We're going to cut Eddie out. We're not going to lean him. So he's fired, you know, he's dismissed." So of course, my agent called me. I wanted to jump off a cliff, you know. So yeah. She said, "Tell you what, we're going to go to church. We're going to pray." This is a true story. So we're going to go to church and pray. I'm Jewish, but I said, okay. So she picks me up at my house, my little apartment, my little $125 a month apartment. We drove to a church. It's still in Hollywood. It's called Our Mother of Good Counsel Church. We went there. She gave me matches. He said, "We're going to light candles at an altar and pray." So I took the candles. I lit two candles at an altar. I go, "Please, dear God, let something good happen. Please, dear God, let something good happen." I prayed very fervently, you know.
Yeah.
A couple days later, Paramount called back, and they said, "We're putting Eddie back in the film. We decided to keep him in the movie." Now, you could take that as a religious story. If you're religious, you say that was divine intervention. I've told this story a lot of times. Religious people say it's divine intervention. My atheist friends, my secular friends say it was just a lucky break. You got a lucky break. But that was like one of the most beautiful stories about Grease, and that's a true story. That's how I got the movie.
Whoa, that would kind of convert me. Has it like influenced you going forward? Do you find yourself becoming more religious because of things like that?
Yeah, well, you know, DK, I've had a lot of my prayers come true, so I'm kind of agnostic, but I tend to believe more than I disbelieve. I'd say I'm 70% a believer, 30% a disbeliever. You know, the disbelief side is you see all the cruelty in the world, you know, you see the other side of the coin. You know, horrible, you know, kids dying, all the horror, the torture, the wars, and, you know, my good friends dying at an early age, horrible death. So that makes you wonder, you know, but I've been very lucky myself.
Oh, nice. I mean, I know you've talked, obviously, you know, it's one of your most famous roles. So I know you've talked about it a great deal over the years. And if not, fine, don't worry about it. Is there anything that you've never told anyone about working on the movie? Or do you think you've kind of gone through all your stories, as it were?
on Grease. Let me see. Well, this is kind of, I've told this story a couple times. Jeff Conaway tried to get me laid, you know. When we did Grease, I was a virgin. And I was very green, you know. I'd never been with a woman. And Jeff Conaway tried to get me laid. He was trying to get me set up with a hooker. And I was very scared, you know. I remember being on a set real scared. I was in my dress in my little trailer. Thinking, oh, my God, you know, I was just so green. I was 20. I was totally innocent. I lost my virginity the next year at the age of 21. But it never happened. But that was kind of that was a scary moment for me. Jeff was kind of a sinister character. He was the only one in the cast that was kind of a little bit scared of. But then, interestingly, later on, Jeff and I did the signing circuit together. We did several signing shows together, Kinnicky and Eugene, and we would sign side by side. And he was like an older brother to me. He told, you know, I was signed when I first started doing signing shows, I would sign for $5 a picture. And he goes, what are you doing charging those 1960s prices? He goes, jack it up to $20. And I jacked my price to $20, and I found everybody paid, you know. So he helped me there, you know, and he looked after me. He was actually a great guy, Jeffy. Yeah, I loved him.
It's such a shame that he passed, because I was a big yeah. fan of him, and he's not just in Grease, but in some of his later work as well. So it was such a shame yeah. that he passed on.
Yes, he was such a wonderful guy.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Grease, the original, is the gold standard. But what did you mm-hmm. personally prefer? Was it the original or the sequel?
For me, DK, there's no contest. I think Grease blows Grease 2 out of the water, no question. Yeah. But Steve and I, when we do shows, Steve will always ask people, just, you know, whenever a fan comes up, he'll go, let me ask you a question. He just does it as a lark. He goes, do you like Grease 1 or Grease 2 better? Now, Denise, Steve's wife, likes Grease 2 better. Drew Barrymore actually said she likes Grease 2 better. Over the years, I've met maybe 70 or 80 people over 50 years that have liked Grease 2 better. Some like better. But interestingly, they're always women. I've never met a man who liked Grease 2 better than Grease. Women like Grease 2, I think, because the guy is hot. Maxwell Caulfield, the lead guy, is hot, and they're attracted to him, you know. But
yeah.
women will occasionally say they like it's better. But I think, you know, for me, Danny and Sandy is it. You know, Danny and Sandy blows everybody else out of the water. That's why I thought Grease 2 would bomb, you know. I thought without Danny and Sandy, you know, they're going to lose that magic. The first day on the set on Grease 2, I went in, and Maxwell Caulfield, he's a lovely guy. He's a beautiful guy. He called me into his dressing room. He said, Eddie, would you like to come into my dressing room? I go, sure. He served me tea and cookies. He's a proper British guy. So I'm sipping tea and having cookies. And I'm thinking to myself, as great as Max was, he was a great guy. I'm thinking, this movie is going to bomb so bad. I go, this guy is going to be in the lead with Dan, you know, he's going to follow John Travolta as Danny Zuko, you know, and then... I met Michelle only one time on the set, and I was mesmerized. She was Marilyn Monroe beautiful. She looked like a young Marilyn Monroe. She was just drop-dead gorgeous, you know. So I'm being a guy, you know, it's like 24 hours in a daze. So I walked up to her like a zombie. I go, you're beautiful. And she said, thank you. That was the only time I ever talked to her.
Oh, right. I mean, there were you mentioned that it bombed. I mean, there were rumors of further movies. Had it been successful, were you involved in any of those discussions? Did anyone approach you at the time? Or
no, not that I ever heard. I knew Grease 2 had been disappointing at the box office, so I figured it was over. Grease 2 was kind of a different kind of film, you know. There was actually an interesting scene Stevie told me. I think Joel Thurm, the casting director, told me. He said they were planning at the end of Grease 2 for, you know, Michael and Stephanie, who was, you know, Maxwell Caulfield and Michelle Pfeiffer, they were together. They pull into a gas station, and the gas station is run by Danny and Sandy, and John Travolta and Olivia come out, and they have a cameo. And I said, that would have killed it. That would have brought the house down, you know, in any theater, but for some reason they didn't do that. So that was the only thing I heard about it. But as far as what you said, Grease 3, no, I never heard anything about it. Nothing. Uh-huh. I just figured, you know, Grease 2 bombed, so they're not going to do a 3 if it bombed, you know. For a movie to have a sequel, it's got to make money. The 3 just has to make money, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned it earlier with regards to Jeff, but you've done a lot of shows since. How is it meeting up with cast members from back in those days?
Always good. Everybody's nice. Grease, I loved everybody. Grease 2, I loved everybody. Let's see. There's one cast member. I don't want to say his name because I don't want to start anything on it to hurt the guy. But I had kind of a falling out with him. We were Facebook friends, and I put a picture on my page that he didn't like. He goes, you've got to take that down and take down. It was a picture. You know, DK, you're a Facebook friend. And look on my page today, okay? Look at my post. And I have Eddie Deason is in a relationship.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I do that with, you know, it's a running gag. I'll put a really sexy girl, you know, with big boobs, and I'll put Eddie Deese in a relationship. So I did one of those. I had a girl, and she was like scanty dress, or she had big boobs. And he goes, Eddie, you've got to take that down. It makes us all look bad. And I go, you're not going to tell me what to put on my Facebook page. It's a joke. Nobody cares.
Yes.
And he's got offended, you know. He's acting like a Karen, you know. So I unfriended him, you know, and we haven't spoken since then. So I don't see him anymore. But he's one of the Grease cast members. It's not John, but I'm not friends with him. But everybody else I'm friendly with. And I'm going to do a show with them, I think, in November. The Grease cast is going to get together to do a show. So that'll be fun.
So, yeah, we had a great time there talking to Eddie. And if you want to hear anything else with regards to Grease or any of his other projects throughout his career, we do have a full interview up online. So if you want to click on that, it's a really good interview. I appreciate you coming on to talk about that, Eddie. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah, please do check that out. Assuming all you listeners out there are still with us and didn't click out once the chat with Eddie ended, we're now going to round things up with our final thoughts and scores. You know the drill by now. So we'll go our guests first. Adrian, let's hear your roundup and score out of 5 for Grease, please.
I want to thank everybody that got together and made this movie. I loved it as a little girl. It still has some strong points now. I know it would be much changed if they did a full remake of it, but thank you for everybody that did it. I'm going to give this movie a 4 out of 5.
Cool. Rune?
I'm going to give this one a 5. I do think it's an iconic watch for sure. But not for kids, and definitely with the right perspective on the world. But yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's fun to watch.
Cool. Yeah, I'm just going to say it's a fun one. It's not aged well in some respects, but it's still a great time. The music's good. It's catchy. It's full of good performances by likable characters. The production design's good. And obviously, as we all know, it's just got a cracking soundtrack. Yeah. I just genuinely enjoy it when I do put it on. It's not something I watch with any regularity, but every time I go back, I still enjoy it, and it's a 4 from me. So over to you, Mike.
It's a musical, so it should come as no surprise that I enjoy this. While I do acknowledge that large parts of it have aged like unrefrigerated milk in a heatwave, there's perhaps no other film that captures such a vivid snapshot of a time, not just in our culture, but especially in our lives. I couldn't begin to explain all the reasons why the film has endured across the generations, but perhaps part of its lasting appeal lies in the universal relatability of its coming-of-age story. Who cares if the high schoolers are clearly in their 30s? The performances feel genuine, and we all find pieces of ourselves in them. Now, to get a bit critical, I know, I do have to say that I'm not a fan of the ending. It's probably a bit of a party pooper take, but the final message seems dangerously close to, girls, change yourselves, get a man. This is softened somewhat by Danny's willingness to change, but in today's climate, this wouldn't land as well. 1978 feels a long time ago in many respects. That said, I have nothing but praise for the cast, even the minor players who all shine. 90% of the songs have become cultural standards for a reason. They're just that good. The direction nails the tone and feel of the piece perfectly. If I'm nitpicking, there's a couple of moments I'd trim to tighten up the runtime and possibly speed up the pacing, but these are minor complaints. Overall, this film is iconic. Having been watched and loved by multiple generations, it's something genuinely special, which is why it endures. It may not be everyone's cup of tea, but if you open your mind and give it a try, you'll find yourself transported to Rydell High. And I also gave it a 4, actually, out of 5.
Nice one. So that works out, if you concur, Mike, with a cult classic score of 4.25 out of 5.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Nice one. Which is, you know, pretty darn good. Looks like good. This is the one a lot of us want, yeah?
Lots of people are hopelessly devoted to it.
Any more puns? Please jump in. So that does it for this one. Hopefully you out there have enjoyed yourself. And if you feel like popping the movie on and having a sing-along after this one, then yeah, you're welcome. As we take our curtain call, all that's left is to thank today's guests for their insights. So first of all, Rune, thank you.
Thank you.
Have you enjoyed yourself today?
I have enjoyed myself. It's always lovely talking with y'all, and I've enjoyed meeting Adrian.
Nice. Anything you'd like to share with our listeners while you're here? Any current or upcoming projects or any socials where people can find you?
You can find me online at Rune Vaughn or at Rune Vaughn Actor, and got no projects coming up right now, so it's kind of chill.
Cool. Adrienne, once more, thank you for taking the time out to jump on this episode.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I hope to be back for more. It was really great to meet Rune and hear y'all's voices again. I'm not on social media right now that much. So anyway.
So nowhere that people can find you?
Just on Mike's Discord is the best place.
Fair enough. Oh, you're becoming dangerously close to being as misanthropic as I am.
Wow.
So, yeah, Mike, cheers once again for coming on this one, fella. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. Cheers for putting it on the schedule. It's good.
Yeah, nice one. Well, we'll be flashing up our links at the end with regards to the show, but is there anything else you want to draw everyone's attention to?
No, I mean, we've kind of been through a bit of a rebrand, as people will know by now. So what was the Mike's Podcast Network, which seemed a little bit egotistical, is now Media Matters. Our previously Hit or Miss Star Trek channel is now Hit or Miss Who Trek. We've added Doctor Who reviews. And otherwise, the rest of the Silver Screen stuff is as it was. So as you were, we've got cult classics, cinema classics, and Silver Screen regular flavor. And you can stay tuned for all of that for the rest of this year. We've got some pretty big plans and some cool ideas, hopefully, for films to cover. So hopefully we'll get the views on them.
Exciting.
Groovy. So as ever, we'll put all the links for today's guests in the description, as well as the link to my full interview with the awesome Mr. Eddie Deason. Thank you once again, Eddie. And yeah, please do go and check that out. If you're a fan of Eddie's work, I guarantee you'll love it. And yeah, we'll be back again first Tuesday of next month with yet another cult classic. So if you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. And I hope to see you then. And until that fateful day arrives on which we meet, remember...
Summer dreams ripped at the seams, but oh, the whole summer night.
Ooh, tell me more, tell me more. Well done.
Nice.
Wonderful.
Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to the Cult Classic Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, with special guest, Eddie Deason. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network. Copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.